Okay, thank you, Nick. So the title here is Simulating Shear and Somewhat More Complex Flows. What I mean by more complex here, I added more complex because the geometry is going to be shear-like, but you'll see that the flow actually is not a linear profile or anything like that. It's actually quite complicated. That's what I meant. Here, and there I am, Jimmy Fan, and also Georgia will give the second part of the talk. And see, Wes gave such a nice summary the other day. What essentially we'll be doing, Georgia and I, is to take two or three of the things that Wes mentioned and go further to give you the details of some of the things that he mentioned. So I'll use just this picture, sort of from Wes's talk, as introduction, as the background or the motivation. So this is the shear viscosity, and this is in a shear flow. You have the three regions, 1, 2, 3. When you shear pretty hard, you enter this regime where the molecular orientation is disturbed by the flow. So there's the so-called molecular viscoelasticity. For that, I use the, you could use the Doi theory. That actually applies, and it works pretty well in some cases. People have done calculations. They have tumbling, wagging, and aligning transitions. They have the N1, N2 doing funny things. Those have been predicted by the Doi theory, so that's great. And if you go down in the shear rate regime, you enter the what Wes called the scaling regime, where you could use the phenomenological Larson-Doi theory that deals with how the domains rotate and so on. And you can predict the transients pretty well too, although the theory is not as fundamentally satisfying. You know, it's just kind of a, there's a phenomenon, you know, there's parameters and things like that. And then you go to this region one, which is where the mystery really lies, because we don't know what it is for the most part. You could use the Leslie Erickson theory, conceivably, because that's where the molecular distribution is not driven too far from the equilibrium uniaxial state. So what is really happening is just a spatial distortional elasticity. Okay, so I'll be talking about two things, molecular viscoelasticity and distortional elasticity. And that's where distortional elasticity is important. And you think, huh, Leslie Erickson should be okay. But there's one problem with the Leslie Erickson, though. That is, you do not have a rational description of defects. Okay, with the Leslie Erickson, you'll have to carve out the core and assign a fixed energy to it. That's it. You'll say, my core has this much energy, and that's about all I can say about it. So, and in this regime, of course, the material always looks polydomain with lots of defects in it. So it looks like you cannot really use the Leslie Erickson to handle this regime one here. So what can you do then? What we're going to tell you today are two things that we try to do to answer that question. The first one is we want to use the Leslie Erickson theory, but not to start with the polydomain structure in place, because if you do, how do you handle the defects? So instead, we go around, we say, we use the Leslie Erickson theory on a monodomain, on a well-aligned single crystal, and then we do shear flow and see whether we can generate defects out of this this flow.
I might be wrong about this, but it occurs to me that not everyone understands, it's possible that not everyone understands exactly what the Leslie Erickson theory is or what the distinction between it and the other theories are.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. Sorry. So let's see.
I thought that was discussed on whether Tuesday or Monday.
It was.
No, Wes mentioned it.
Yeah. No equations.
No equations. All right. Why don't I? Okay, I'll just say a few words, and then I'll show you equations, and then you'll see better. The Leslie Erickson theory is a linear theory. It has no intrinsic viscoelasticity in it. It has it's a combination of a viscous fluid and a linearly elastic kind of constitutive equation. You put the two things together. You have a viscosity there. You have a linear sort of linear elasticity in there. That's what it is. Okay. You'll see more of that.
Is it fair to say that it's a theory where the order parameters are director, so that you always have full scalar order?
Yes, you can say that. It comes out to be a limit of the more complex viscoelastic Doi theory, when the molecular orientation distribution is not too far from equilibrium. Actually, it stays. You assume that the viscous molecular distribution function stays at equilibrium state, then you reduce the more complex theory to this linear theory. It's just a linear limit in a way.
You made the statement that in the Leslie Erickson theory you can't deal with cores and you have to carve out a section and say this is too much energy. I don't know why you said that, since part of the Leslie Erickson theory is K1, K2, K3 to gauge how much energy there is.
Yes, you say the core energy is K times something, a constant. That's what you say. But what I'm saying is you cannot do a rational analysis of what's happening in the core, because what you have to work with in the Leslie Erickson theory is the director. It's a vector. And if you get to this defect line here, let's say you have homeotropic anchoring everywhere, and let's say you have a line defect in the middle, and let's forget about escape for the moment. If you come to the center here, the vector would come head to head like that. You have a truly geometric defect, which you cannot handle in the theory. That's what I mean.
Yeah, with S constant.
Yes. What you do then, you'll draw this out and you'll say this has a fixed energy, then you can talk about the rest of the material.
If you want to treat the material only, but you like to treat the effects, you have to introduce
it. So the two things that I'm going to talk about is, the first thing is I want to apply this simple theory to a simple shear flow, and to try to understand how defects are generated to begin with from a single crystal. If I can do that, I could probably imagine that I can refine, I can further simulate texture refinement and also the start of the texture, you know, of a part of the texture. That's one thing. The second thing is to forget about this theory altogether and to start with the so-called complete theory. That's what Wes mentioned this also the other day. So this theory, in principle, covers the whole regime, has everything in it. And I'll tell you about our shot at building such a theory. And then Georgia will talk about the predictions for such a theory in certain flow situations. So this is pretty much a repeat of what I just said. So we have three things here. I'll be talking about the first two, and Georgia the last, number three. That's the plan of the talk. So the first thing then is Leslie Erickson simulation of a simple shear flow, starting with a single crystal. Okay, this idea was motivated by experiments done by Larson and Mead a while back. What they did is they took I believe it's PBG solution, and they align the molecules in the vorticity direction to begin with. So it's a single crystal well aligned. And then they start a very slow shear, and the shear rate is very, very low, so you don't need to worry about viscoelasticity. And when you do the shear, and when the shear rate is really low, you have nothing. It stays a single crystal. The director does what's called log rolling. It just, you know, rolls along, nothing happens. Okay. And if you cross a threshold, then this flow becomes unstable. You have a bifurcation into, you see those stripes in the flow direction. So the shear flow goes like that. The stripes would be along my fingers here. You would have dark and bright and those stripes. That's what's in here, the stripes. If you shear it a little harder, the texture refines and becomes somewhat irregular. And then somehow defects start to occur. You would have defect lines appearing along the flow direction like that. I'll show you pictures in a little bit. And eventually, if you go even higher in your shear rate, you enter this very chaotic regime, which has been called director turbulence. Let me show you copies of their photographs here, which didn't come out very well. This is okay, but with the later regimes, it doesn't look too good on my transparency. But this is the regular stripes. Though this is the regime for regular stripes, so you have more or less regular, parallel. If you go higher in the Erickson number, which is, you can think of it as the dimensionless shear rate here, the Erickson number, and this is the irregular regime.
What
I'm sorry?
What instability appear?
That depends on how you define your Erickson number. And in my definition, it's around 50. I use the viscosity. The thickness is 50 microns or so, 25, 50 microns. And I use the viscosity alpha 4, and one half of that as my viscosity. So that depends on what you choose as your characteristic viscosity.
The transition in stability is independent of all
yes.
of the parameters I just questioned.
They come in a combination called the Erickson number.
So it's a constant Erickson number always?
Yes. It's the Erickson number. Let me put it in here. Later I'll need it anyway. So there is your thickness, there is the velocity, there is a characteristic viscosity, and that's the elastic constant.
Alpha 4 is which component of viscosity? I mean, so let's, if this is the pneumatic axis, then alpha 4 corresponds to shearing which way?
Oh, alpha 4 is the Newtonian component, actually. If I write out the stress tensor, I would have alpha 1. Let me just give you alpha 4. I don't quite remember. That's what it is, alpha 4. This being one half of, yes. So I took this because this allows me to cast my equation like in a Stokes-like form. It just looks more comfortable to me, at least.
And the viscosity of the log rolling orientation is proportional to that, right? Or is it?
Alpha 4?
Yeah.
Is it? I think it's a combination.
Alpha 4 divided by 2 is the
storage
viscosity.
Right, right.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So to get back to Mike's question, actually, this is not the only parameter. You also need to specify the ratios of all the alphas. They apparently matter
right.
Also.
For instability, you use the viscosity of the stable flow. Isn't you using it for the transition?
The viscosity of the material.
Of the material in the below.
There's no shear thinning. Those are constant viscosities.
Right. So below the stability, there is a well-defined viscosity.
But even after the instability, the viscosity is the same for the material.
Will that the apparent viscosity will be some other combination, but it will be higher viscosity.
Does it change when
you mean apparent viscosity? No, that's not what I'm talking about. So I write out my constitutive equation. I have this list of parameters, which I call alphas, and that's what I use to define my Erickson number.
Maybe to clarify for people who don't know anything about this, before the stability, the viscosity is, there's no shear thinning at all?
No.
So there's a well-defined viscosity.
There's no shear thinning in the left area.
There's no shear thinning, whatever.
No, I'm talking about experiment, I'm sure it's not.
Okay.
The experimental, before the stability, the viscosity is shear independent.
True.
And so if you plug that viscosity into this equation, do you get the same transition at the same Erickson number, independent of thickness, for example, independent of your viscosity of your material?
Yes, if you specify the answer is yes. If you specify the Erickson number, if you specify the ratio of all the alphas, the transition will happen in the same Erickson number. That's true.
That's not quite true, right? Because it's also going to depend on the other viscosity.
That's what I said, the ratio of viscosity. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Yes.
The point is that Erickson number alone is not enough. There are other material dimensionless material parameters which also
right.
So the transition will appear at different Erickson numbers.
For different materials.
For different materials, yes. For different alphas, yes, that's true.
Because of this possibility design.
Yes. And this picture here, this is a blow-up here. It's supposed to show us disclinations. This is where my transparency actually fails us. I think there is a defect line here and somewhere in there. It's not clear, but those appear they appear to lie in the flow direction, those defect lines. They're thick lines. That's what they have seen.
In the first picture, the stripes themselves are all, in the previous transparency, the stripes there are supposed to be defect lines, or are they actually pneumatic director?
Those are not defects. Those are just some optical lines because your polarizers, and this just shows you.
You have some sort of flow that has.
Has it already developed some rolls or something? Which way?
Yes.
Is it? Yeah.
Rolls. Yes.
Okay. Fine. Yes. That's all right.
The flow goes like this.
It flows like this, and it's
yes.
It's
you're looking this way.
Fine.
So that's why you see the stripes like my fingers.
Right. And the vector itself is oriented?
On the walls, or the initial condition is like this.
Okay.
Okay. So if you...
For the sake of the generality, you say there are many different types of bands under flow, I think.
Yes.
This is, you know, bands along the flow direction, but there are also being observed bands perpendicular.
And we'll actually, Georgia will actually touch on that. You know, that depends on the geometric setup of your experiment. Yeah.
The period of this thing depends on
age somehow? The wave number.
Yes.
I think it does. It does through the Erickson number. So if you go still higher in your shear rate, you get quite irregular and chaotic, but eventually all textures would disappear as you enter the DOI, the so-called Deborah number cascade, where the distortional elasticity becomes irrelevant. Basically, it's just molecular viscoelasticity here.
What are those points?
Those are nothing. This comes out of the copy machine. I don't know why. Lost in the reproduction. All right, so now I'm going to tell you about the theory before after this slide. The stripes are nothing. The stripes are nothing new. People have done linear instability analysis of the Leslie Erickson theory, based on which they have learned that as you cross a threshold, you would have such rows occurring. So the top is going in, the bottom is fixed, and you would have rows like that, like the Taylor rows in shear flow of Newtonian fluid. And then if you look this way, you'll see stripes. So that's known, nothing new there. What I'm trying to show here are two things. First of all is I'm going to carry out this instability to finite amplitude, to whatever, however it evolves. So my simulation, because it's a direct calculation, it's not restricted to the linear instability, the smallest infinitesimal disturbance there. And second thing is I'm going to carry it so far as to see defects actually occur. That's my main interest.
I'm assuming the rows are the flow lines.
Those are secondary flows.
Right.
But the primary flow goes in, so it's a swirling flow.
What is the director doing in those rows?
I'll show you in a little bit, okay?
You guys are too patient.
Yes, be a little patient. And have faith. Okay. So here's the constitutive equation, the Leslie-Erickson theory. I didn't plan to say too much about this slide. So the Leslie-Erickson theory describes the pneumatic material by using a single vector, what's called the director. And this director rotates in space because of viscous torque on it and because of elastic torque on it. Because if its neighbor goes this way, this is affected. So there's elastic, you know, there is a resistance to this. So the rotation of this director then is determined by a balance between the elastic torque and the viscous torque here. The viscous torque then has to do with this rotation and angular velocity. That's the rotation of the director with respect to the background fluid. So this equation then determines the evolution of the director n. And once you know that, you can write a stress tensor, which has a sort of static distortional part. This is like linear elasticity here. This is the Erickson stress. And then you have this viscous stress here with the six alphas there. And this alpha 4, that's the Newtonian one, which I have picked to use to define my Erickson number. And then you can insert this into a flow equation. I have no inertia here. But this problem is dynamic. It's not steady state because there's rotation here. So this enters the stress, so the whole thing then becomes a dynamic evolution. It's not a steady state, although I do not have DDT explicitly. So that's my system. All right? And the geometry of the problem is like this. Top plane goes in, bottom plane fixed, and I assumed that nothing changes along the z direction. So my problem is just varying on this cross-section then. Okay, that's a major assumption. I'll come back to that later on. And I use finite difference, a regular mesh, that's okay. A few numerical issues, the first thing is how wide should my domain be? Because beforehand, before I do the calculation, I do not know that what the dominant width number is going to be. And my setup will allow me only integer numbers of pairs, of course. So there's a little bit of cutoff at the edge. So what I did is testing different width and see whether they differ. If they don't, then I'm fine. So I, for the most part, this W is 8 times the gap size H. And then the director is anchored on all the walls everywhere. On the side walls, I make the shear stress vanish. So the side walls are slippery walls. The velocity doesn't vanish there, but the shear stress does. So it's slippery walls in there. And initially, I would align my director in the vorticity direction, like which is, in this case, which is x, just like in the experiment. And then I'll let the flow go. If I do that, the flow will go on forever, because it just so happens that the runoff error also disappears here. So there's no disturbance. I had to manually insert an initial disturbance, it turns out. So I randomly disturb the director a little bit with a very tiny magnitude, 10 to the minus 4, 5. And then I let the flow go and see whether the disturbance will die out or will get amplified. So that's my setup.
Can you comment on why round of air disappears?
Say it again, please.
Why does round of air disappear? Why does it go?
If I do not supply an initial disturbance?
Round of air.
Why the runoff just appears? Just disappears? Because my mesh is as 2 to the times n here, and everything is just exactly represented. It just so happens. That's a very peculiar thing. Okay?
Would you be able to incorporate an anchoring strength? It's not an experiment, it's a different boundary.
I don't think you can do that inside this celestial action theory, because what you have here is just n. That's it. And either n, you have to give it a direction. That's it. You cannot. There's no room for further information as to how n can be distorted in here. There's no order parameter.
You would just change the, in addition to the Frank free energy, you can put in boundary terms where there's a, or in a field.
If you,
put in some sort of elastic bending, how much it costs you to put.
Yeah, I think you're just putting, apart from the bulk free energy function, you have the.
It'll come out like a Neumann condition for the director.
Yeah, it'll be like,
you could do that, I guess. Yeah. And in my case, it's all Dirichlet, all over. So n is fixed. Now, results. I have 4 regimes, basically. If you shear slowly, nothing happens, not interesting. And then you have steady state roll cells. And then the roll cells start to oscillate. And finally, you have a irregular pattern, and that's where defect lines appear. This fourth one apparently is the most interesting, but I'll talk about 2 and 3 as well.
Do you use the same definition of the Erickson number as Manneville? You get similar numbers for the critical Erickson?
I'll comment on that at the end. I'll compare with the experiments. You'll see. Manneville's, I'll come back to that. Steady state roll cells, just like what I drew here in my cartoon a few slides before. So this is the geometry. The top plane goes in, the primary flow goes in. So this is the secondary flow, which is about 1% of the primary flow. Not too big. And what's interesting is if you look at the orientational field here, you'll see a correspondence between the two. Okay. So those little vectors here on top are the director. That's the director field here. So on the wall, the director is horizontal. On the side, it's like that. But in the middle, the director could tip up and also rotate out of this plane, more into the flow direction. So that's what happens here. I use slightly shorter vectors if it goes out of the plane. It's not. I don't know if you can see it. But the most interesting thing that I want to draw your attention to is that the most severe distortion occurs at the core of the swirl. Okay, on the boundary between the swirls the director is undisturbed, basically. It's still horizontal. So that's the main thing that's interesting here.
But in this regime, the director distortions are all essentially elastic distortions. You don't have, the entire thing can still be described as slow distortions of on the average oriented grid in this state.
It's elastic distortions. That's opposed to what? I don't have anything else.
As opposed to places where the director description has to break down, where you have vortices. You
haven't generated,
don't generate any discriminations at this stage.
Not here. But eventually, when I have my discriminations, the director doesn't really break down because of a fortunate coincidence, you'll see.
They all strength one and escape.
Yeah, they all escape. You know that already. Sorry. There goes my surprise.
How do you know when the... Some you need to introduce a third direction in terms of right now everything is the same in the flow direction.
No, the flow direction actually goes into the board.
Right.
I'm looking at the plane perpendicularly. Yeah.
They allow things to be homogeneous in the flow direction. When do you know there will be another instability
no.
in the flow direction? How do you know when to turn it on?
The answer is no. I do not allow anything to change in the flow direction. That's a major assumption.
And so how do you know when this is good?
I'll compare with experiments. You'll see. Okay.
Sorry, one last question about the period here. It always comes out to be that these pair of rolls fit in one picture. Period. Instead of the other stack. I mean, as you go to different widths.
Okay.
Here.
Okay.
Do you find that the period starts to deviate at all from?
Not too much. The change a bit. When I go from 8 to 16, the change probably by 10% or something, the wave number.
Okay.
Maybe even not,
yeah,
not that much.
Not
it's not a big deal. So this may not be the most dangerous mode, but it's pretty close. That we can say.
But if you go from 8 to 8.5, you don't shift like transition by more than 50%.
You go to 8.5.
Well,
you will add maybe one half cell.
You don't know whether the cell has to be perfectly square.
Oh, I ask it to be perfectly square because I on the sidewalls, yes, on the sidewalls the director has to be horizontal.
No, I understand that. I'm saying that the cell you're forcing it to be square by your boundary condition.
My boundary conditions are fixed. So the cells if they want to tilt, they could. But they don't
no.
Is that what you're saying, Kingo?
No, what I'm mm-hmm. saying is that you're making it commensurate with your height. So you're forcing it the number of rolls is defined in such a way that
the question is to what extent is the wavelength in the box fixed by the choice of the aspect ratio?
Right.
Not quite. It's well by fixing this box at 8, right, I could allow only an integer number of cells. So you have a choice, you have available to you a number of wavelength. And the most dangerous among them would come out. If you make your cell wider, you'll get ever closer to the you have more choice as to the wavelength that you allow because you only allow an integer number of cells.
But lambda comes out to be very close to
yeah.
H within
yeah.
a numerical
well, you're forced to be. Yeah, but if you go to 60, can you go to
no, it's if you go to 16, you'll double those number of cells, maybe with one extra. So that 1/2/16 is your maximum error.
Right.
Yeah. So it cannot be 4 cells like this. It cannot be just or 10. It's not arbitrary. It comes out
but
close.
Yeah. If you made 8.5 and the transition occurred earlier, it means that your choice was not the best one. It actually wanted to be a slightly not square but rectangular.
You may have a single. You may not have pairs. Is that what you're saying?
He's just saying if you change the aspect ratio of the box,
mm-hmm.
it might change. Well, that allows some different wavelength, and that might change the onset condition. Basically.
Yes.
The transition point, possible.
The stability of the
that's possible. Yes. The aspect ratio. Yes. The transition point may come a little lower because you'll now get closer to the most dangerous mode. That may be, but I trust the difference is not big.
But also, if you have a wide enough box, you might have some effect near to the side of your box where there you have a different aspect ratio of the rows. But the you hope that at the center of the box, you have the real the real aspect ratio. So you not necessarily you have a uniform wavelength across the box.
Right.
You might be there just at the side, and if you make it large enough, that should take care of the problem.
And the wavelength doesn't change with shear rate, just you assume.
Yes, it does. It certainly does. You will see. You will see. Okay. You will see some of the. Okay. You'll see. Here's just a picture of what you might see if you look now on top of the cell. You know, just because of the periodic variation of the director, you see this pattern. So this is the steady row cell. Not very interesting. The most interesting thing about it is that nothing dramatic happens. I mean, I'm showing you now the time history of three components of N. At some point in the flow field, let's just pick it and I'll see the history. Initially, this one is nx, that's one because it's horizontal initially. And then when the row cell occurs, this thing adjusts itself and it approaches a steady state. So there's nothing really dramatic in the development of those row cells. And that's, I showed you that picture because I want to contrast that with this next one. That's the next regime. As you go higher in your shear rate, you have this oscillatory solution. And I'll just give you one picture to show you what's happening during the oscillation. The cells are no longer rectangular, up and down. Instead, they tend to split like this, or then they come back. So each one is oscillating, but there is a phase change in here. And that phase change from numerical experiments seems to be related to the aspect ratio. If I make longer, the way that this wave-like, the phase change would the phase lag would vary. Okay, so that one may be a numerical artifact.
Do those guys ever pinch?
Not pinch off. No, not here. But it will eventually at a higher regime.
The okay, threshold let's, for this will also depend on the box.
The threshold.
Because you've pinned it on it.
I tend to say no. I think. I don't think the critical point depends on the critical point for the onset of oscillation depends so much on the aspect ratio. I don't think so.
Why? So you said so much that it depends on
because I don't remember exactly how I did the.
It seems to me that these guys are saying that there should be a commensurability effect, and you're saying that it's not a big deal, and both statements are probably true.
You're selecting the solution. Right?
Okay.
And the actual solution depends on your boundary. You're phasing in a given period. You're selecting the period with your boundary condition.
Kind of.
Isn't the period basically determined by the height of the box and not by these other things?
It is. It's up to.
The defined period would be limit for the box is very wide.
As far as my width number is concerned. I pretty much, my error is pretty much this much, I think. You know, something like that. I mean, you miss at most half a cell at the edge. That's it. That's it. As to whether, by having this error at the edge, how does that change my threshold Erics number for the onset of oscillation?
It'll suppress the oscillations, for sure. But the question is how much.
Yeah, so. You can say the same probably for the onset of the row cells as well. No. But I don't think that should be a major issue.
You see correlations in the solution between different parts of your
cell? There seems to be, you would see a wave propagating. It's like a wave. There's a phase lag. See, those guys are doing that, and then this guy's, you can see that. And that phase lag is related to the box. If I make it wider, that propagation gets slower. Not so much. The phase lag will decrease. In this particular case, it comes to the center. But if I do the 16 one, it actually moves slowly to one side. Okay. All right. Now let me go to my final. And most interesting regime here, that's the irregular regime. So I'm showing you once again the history of N at one particular point. This is where the row cells start to form, and they grow a little bit, and then they become apparently irregular in time. And spatially, this is what happens. the cells start to separate like that, and that goes back to past point. They do start to pinch off to separate into two cells, and they're not coming back in this case. Oh yes, good observation. Yes, as you increase the Erickson number, the cells gets narrower, the wave number gets larger, so there's a refinement here.
Is it true in doubling? No,
it's a grad. I will come back to the aspect ratio when I compare with the experiments. You'll see that it's not pure doubling.
But this is not doubling, you're saying? Two cells per
It breaks up and down.
Right.
There's no doubling in this direction.
No, in this direction.
In this direction, it used to be just one. Now it becomes two.
Oh, right.
Yes. You call that?
That's not doubling anyway.
That's not doubling. It's not doubling.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yes, please.
About just a little Erickson theory. So if I just imagine having a single stick sitting in a shear flow, I would guess, maybe this is totally wrong, that the director would actually align with the flow direction. And you're saying that doesn't happen.
Tumbles.
Right.
These sticks represent the orientation, the principal direction of orientation of the distribution. But
right.
You might think of it that way.
Right.
It's not real.
But
sticks.
Maybe my question then is, could you explain again physically what the interaction of the director field with the flow is saying about how they affect each other?
I don't know how physical I can get, except to say that you have a stress tensor there, which depends on the orientation of the material. So the material reacts to deformation differently, depending on the orientational state. So that the stress tensor goes into the momentum balance. So that's how the flow and the orientation are coupled.
There's a coupling.
The man could more slowly might help if you put up you want to put up a graph and you put, let's say, Erickson theory, it might serve as a.
The other thing about this calculation is that directors fix this way at the walls. So the flow might want to line stuff up, but it has to overcome the effects of the boundary collision. And if you increase the Erickson number, you increase
but
the ability.
You're saying that at low flows, I guess this is an experimental fact, that it's perfectly happy being in the vorticity direction.
Yeah.
And it doesn't at all want to.
Yeah, it's stabilized.
That's
by
true.
Starts to tumble,
yeah.
And then that's when
the roll starts. Yeah. I want to add one point to what Wes was explaining to you.
I know you
yes,
a long time ago,
yes. When you have this log rolling state, yes,
yeah.
that's helped
log
by the boundary
like
the boundary conditions. Yes, for sure. But if I'm doing shear like this and your rod is like this in this plane,
yeah.
It's not happily aligned like that. It's not. It could if you change the parameter, but
if this is a tumbling material,
it just goes on.
Okay. Sorry.
Was there anything? You were making a comment.
No.
Okay.
No, just one. So these are not stable flow liners. These are tumblers.
Tumblers. Yes.
Otherwise, you won't get all this stuff.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes, tumblers.
Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a question about connecting the pictures you showed before with these time dependence. At a given point along the slope direction.
Okay.
Because you're looking at a two-dimensional slice, you make an implicit connection between the spatial variation along the flow direction and time dependence at a given point.
In my simulation, I assume nothing changes along flow direction. I'm looking at this only.
Well, okay. The pictures you showed, of course, showed wandering.
No.
We cannot say anything about the.
Right. I know that. But it seems like an obvious connection between the two.
Are you saying that you could say hop on the particle and following the flow down? A connection in that regard?
Let's state it differently.
Mm-hmm.
You see stable rolls in time at a given point in space until a certain threshold, at which point they oscillate in time at that point in space. If I look at a picture without any time difference, at that same threshold,
above or below that same threshold, will I see wandering rolls and straight rolls? Is the same transition?
I lost you when you said if you look at the picture and there's no time dependence.
He's asking, could you take the time dependence in your simulation and interpret it as a static spatial dependence?
No, because and then you miss the gradients along the flow direction as you influence, and so you cannot.
Of course, that's not present here, but is it the same threshold?
I seem to be the only one who didn't get the main point here. How do you connect this time and space thing? Maybe we can talk a little bit later. Can we? You have to draw it for me to understand. Right, standing here, I don't seem to catch up.
Experimentally, do you see the rolls wandering laterally at a given point in space?
Not
time. Do you see them wandering along the flow direction?
I think not. I don't know. I don't remember the experiments. I think not.
But they're all unstudied in both directions.
I think when they see.
It just seemed there might have been an obvious.
I'm not sure the experimental observations are that refined to be able to answer that question.
But you either do or don't see rolls stay at the same point in the cell.
They didn't mention anything about wandering left and right.
No,
what they see is special.
They publish still pictures, they don't publish videos.
So. Let me come back to my cell splitting here. Remind you what I was looking at. So I was saying when you shear hard enough, your cells start to break up like that. And correspondingly, the orientational field has some change also. So you look at. Get this off now. If you look at the cell on the side, this is how the orientation looks like for an unbroken cell, the whole cell. So in the center of the cell, the director tips up and then rotates out. So that's like what you saw before, only that they're narrower now, as you observed, at higher shear rate. But what's more interesting is this butterfly pattern here for the broken cells. So you have those two daughter cells, if you would. And at the center of each cell, the director is mostly out of this plane and almost totally aligned with the flow direction now. So that's an interesting observation because that turns out to be directly related to how defects eventually will come out. So in the center of those broken cells, the director becomes oriented in the flow direction at this point.
Do you know what the secondary flow looks like in this case?
Yeah, it's up there. They sort of start to break up here, the secondary flow. You see the cell.
Those are velocities.
Yes, that's the velocity vector.
Some flow lines make an eight, and some flow lines make different circles.
Do they make eight?
Yeah, basically. I mean.
They actually going like that. They're not exactly eights.
Oh, yeah, they don't
do eights. Okay, as you continue the process, you see the cell, more and more cells get broken, and what's happening here is the cell becomes irregular. You no longer recognize a pair of daughter cells there. It becomes irregular, and that's when defects start to occur. And this is at the same time, I'm looking at the orientational field now. And you still see the whole cell here, so that's the same as before. And you see the broken cells here, the center there. And this is the center of a broken cell. That's what I call the ridge. So because in this region, the director is oriented outward. But in the neighborhood, the director remains in this plane. So as you approach this from the side, you see the director would go up into the flow direction. That's why I call this a ridge. Okay, we have a ridge here. And this used to be a ridge, and now we have a pair of defects, and they're in the escaped configuration, so there's no real singularity. And this is what I think happens here.
You should probably tell the audience about this.
Yes, hold on. This is what I think happens, and then you'll see what I mean by escape. So this is the ridge, all right? You're looking at the ridge. goes out of the board like that towards you? That's clear, right? That's this, let's say.
That's the director fuel.
And that's the director fuel, absolutely. And now you look at this rooftop of the ridge, and the director is just pointed toward you in the flow direction, like that. Whereas in its neighbor, in a neighboring area, it goes out like that. Okay. And if the secondary flow is just right, this rooftop will be split into two, like this. Okay. If it does that, see, if this part goes to your left and this part goes to your right, you would have a defect there already. That's a minus one defect in such a configuration. And let me draw it on the board. Like that. But in the center is out of the board. You see, that's what I mean by escaped. Because if it does not escape into the third dimension, you would have a geometric singularity here, because you have only directors to play with here. You have just the vector. What does it do in the middle? It gets, you know, you have a singularity. Now it escapes to avoid that singularity. And in my dynamics here, leading up to the stage, the director has turned into the flow direction already. So that avoids that problem. Okay. So that's how you end up with escaped minus one defect here. And on this side, the director turning to your left comes into conflict with its neighbors, and that gives you a positive one defect, which is just a radial kind of configuration, also escaped at the core. Okay, so that's how, in my simulation, the pair of disclinations come about.
And they're convected away from each other?
They are going to be convected by the secondary flow.
So, again, how... Is there a way to find out if this solution is stable in the velocity direction?
Not in my simulation, because I do not allow anything to vary in this direction. So those would be defect lines oriented along the flow.
Is, everything is perfectly ordered.
Correct. That's correct.
Which, because the length scales we're talking about here, they have to be
able to reduce. That's true. Experimentally, people start to see, when the defects occur, they start to see spatial variations in this direction as well. They see the lines are a little wavy at this point. So in reality, yes, this is where this flow direction dependence starts to come into the picture. And that's left out in my simulations.
But it's not bad at all. I mean,
this is
in the flow direction.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Yes, Pat?
So one question about the escape. You know, you can, if you start with the radial configuration, and here is the line, here's a line defect with the radial configuration, the escape can be where these things sort of go like this or like this, right? The director is the same, but if you look at the local configuration, you might imagine that there are little
I understand what you're saying, but
do you ever see that in an experiment? Your simulation, of course, rules out any homogeneity along the flow, but you know, when that line, when the defect line escapes.
I think it's all different.
You can't tell the difference in here, right?
Yeah.
You cannot tell the difference.
But this is your simulation anyway.
Yes. In reality, I doubt you could. Either this way or that way.
Now, it's true that the director itself doesn't distinguish head from tail, mm-hmm. but...
I understand. The pattern...
It would go either this way or this way. And so you might expect little points along...
I understand.
...the axis.
Yes.
Excuse me. This theory, the less variation theory, is a vector theory. It has an arrow.
Right. No, it's a variant on the n to minus n.
It has an arrow. If you want to do double arrow theory, you have to work with a tensor.
No, no, no.
You're supposed to have a boundary condition. Right?
No, Alex. I think, no, that's not the point. I think Suryan was right. There's a difference if you go this way or that way.
Yeah.
The pattern has a difference.
You have a little mark on
okay.
the axis, which
is I cannot tell it in my simulation. I doubt you can do it in experiments. That's it. Okay. That's my observation on that.
Okay, the escape. So is that an unphysical nature of the Erich-Leslie theory?
No, it's a very physical nature.
It is
experimentally observed, this escape.
But this is responsible for Erich's theory not being able to capture the defect core. Is this related to
different classes of defects. If you have a half-strength defect, you cannot escape like that. You cannot escape without causing problems here. You cannot escape. So this would, in the Leslie Erichsen theory, this is a true singularity. in this simulation, as well as in experimental observations, you just happen to have integer strength, just positive and positive one, positive and minus one lines, and those are called thick lines. It just so happens you don't have this singularity here.
Sorry, I'm sort of going in the same direction. What is the correlation length in the problem? And to create an effect, you have to create an infinite line at the same time. But in your case, it's a point, so it's not a problem. But in principle, it becomes an infinite line. And so somehow the system has to know throughout the whole very, very long flow direction, it has to make this escape at the same time everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
To do anything about it. Yeah, he has to do 3D
simulation. Yeah, I understand, but how do you envision mapping your 2D to 3D, the propagation?
You could have a nucleation and then propagate. In experiments, they have lines of finite length. So you would have ends.
Finite length means they must close on themselves, right? That's the point. You can't have just dangling ends. With one you can.
And the escape direction can change with the existence of the line.
Experimentally, can you see the thick lines appear well before the thin lines? Is it correct that the first thing that appears?
At least for LCPs, there, as far as I know, there are very few thick lines.
My take on this is it depends on the flow history. If you take a material, you see thin lines and thick lines together.
For example, Kleiman claims that LCP thermotropes,
they don't escape. They don't escape.
Thick lines. So we have to call Kleiman.
but experimentally, in this set of experiments, for both small liquid crystal, small molecular liquid crystals, which Pat dealt with, and the PBG polymers that Larson did, what they saw are thick lines nucleating from the raw cells. Okay, so after that qualification, the results don't look too bad. I'll do a more formal comparison momentarily.
Can your simulation see? Is it possible for your simulation to see the 1/2?
No, not with the not with the theory. Not with the theory. That's true. So after the defects occur, they would be convected all around the place.
Well, the Lesser Erickson theory could predict the formation of fins. Why not? If they were apt to form, say you did the
high
allow
variation in the order of parameters.
How do you calculate the energy associated with the half
well,
line?
You have a cutoff in your simulation from the mesh size.
Yeah.
Would it not be possible for
describe the far field of the defect perfectly well? It's only the core that
energy of the core will converge as the step size goes to zero.
Yes, but you have a finite mesh size, so I'm not sure
it's
impossible.
You have to,
right, so it's possible,
you have to put it in my hand, right?
Yes, physically you cannot, but numerically you just might kind because of that, because of the finite difference.
The ion transition energy. But I think your defects appear as pinching of your induction walls.
Would you call my ridge inversion wall? It's a splay wall, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you can say that.
And it's a pinching of that structure that gives you...
It's a breakup. I don't know whether you can call it pinching.
Okay.
Yes, pinching, yes.
So usually in the pinching of a wall, you could see maybe, I don't know why, you could see a plus or minus.
Here you don't have that.
Given the pre-factor that you find, it would be hard to think how.
Another question?
I still don't quite understand. So are the 1/2 thing something that you could see in the simulation but don't? Or are they something that's never possible to see in your simulation?
Before coming into this room today, I would say you couldn't, because Lesser Erickson theory physically does not allow you to have a singular core.
Okay.
But now there's the insight that if you do a numerical simulation, you could just manage that by using a finite step size, finite spatial grid. So
might
you might compute the core energy But that coordinate would depend on your mesh size, so not very good. Yeah.
You wouldn't get convergence.
Yeah. Okay, so if we want to finish before lunch. So you have the defects, they move about a little bit, and then they annihilate positive one, negative one. You eventually have this kind of a thing, this simmering soup sort of thing. You have those curls moving and interacting, they split and they recombine, they move about, but on the whole, there's not too much change. The whole character stays pretty much the same with the length scale. You see, there are large cells, there are smaller fine structures there. Let me do a comparison with the experiments.
Sorry, when you say it doesn't change, you mean statistically it doesn't change, but lots of little activities going on.
Agree, right? Yes.
It's sort of noisy state. Right?
That's what I meant by simmering.
Yeah,
it's time dependent.
Yes. Especially it's not homogeneous either. So here's the aspect ratio of the wave number. That's Larson's linear instability calculation there. Those symbols are experimental observations, and three red dots are from calculations, so they agree pretty well. And you see, if you increase the shear speed or the Erickson number, the aspect ratio goes down. It's a refinement, as you have noticed already. That's fine. And if you check the numbers, the definition of the Erickson number is different between mine and the experiments, but if you convert them, they come pretty close, as a matter of fact. I missed the other threshold. The threshold for the onset of rule cells, in my case, is about 55. In Larson's experiment, is around 45. And if you compare the onset of the irregularity experimentally, it's 150. In my case, in that neighborhood also, they see a weaker fine structure appears interdispersed among the bigger stripes. And in my simulations, I see the rule cells break up, and that's when I see those escaped thick lines, and I end up with a bifringence pattern like that. You can probably say that this is a structure with big stripes with finer structures in the middle, so that seems to be okay too. I have one more thing to tell you before I yield the podium to Georgia. So this theory is, this simulation is, I just told you, it agrees with experiments, this and that, but it's limited in many ways. The first thing is dimensionality. I do not allow anything to vary in the flow direction. There's a lot of dynamics there. Experimentally, you see the lines become wavy, they break up, the whole thing becomes three-dimensional. So that's missed, that's not captured in here. And I when I prepared this, I didn't think I could represent the half lines. And I couldn't access the higher flow regime where molecular dynamics, molecular risk elasticity comes into the picture. So based on those thoughts, you would think that you need a complete theory. And before coming to Santa Barbara, I think this would be the solution to the whole problem. But after listening to Wes now, I have a better appreciation now of the separation of scales, whether you can use just one theory in one swipe to cover the whole thing. That in my mind becomes more questionable. Maybe you need something like some kind of phenomenological thing to help you transfer information between length scales. That may be the case. I don't know. So what I'm going to do is to tell you our version of the complete theory. This is not the only one. Alex has a theory, and there's another theory as well. I'll tell you our attempt at building this so-called complete theory, and then Georgia will tell you some preliminary, or not so preliminary, some up-to-date results on that. This theory, we use the old DOI theory to do calculations, so we like the DOI theory a lot. So we decided to basically generalize the old DOI theory to get this new complete theory. Let me say a few things that may not be news to you, but the Leslie-Erickson theory, as I mentioned, it doesn't have the molecular risk elasticity in it. Okay, it doesn't have any polymer dynamics in it at all. The DOI theory, on the other hand, has the viscoelastic elasticity, but doesn't have the distortional elasticity. My task, then, is to combine those two elements. The DOI theory has the molecular dynamics, molecular viscoelastic elasticity in it already. How do I include this sort of Frank elasticity into this on a molecular level? That's the main thing. And I choose to do that by using this Marucci-Grieco potential energy. And the DOI theory used this Myers-Oppy energy, which does not take into account any spatial variation of the distribution function. Now, the Marucci and Grieco, they try to incorporate that into this nematic energy. That's the mean field theory. So you take this test rod, and there's the background in there, and you realize that the distribution function varies from point to point. How do you integrate the background to get a nematic energy? That's what they did. They introduced this interaction length L, and then they cut out this region, and they did a spatial averaging of the interaction there to get an average kinematic energy. That's what they did. So they have, this is the Myers-Oppy term, the old one, when there's no spatial variation is there. And this is the new term, this Laplacian term here. That's due to the spatial variation. The first order term drops out because if you do the integration, if you have a linear variation of the distribution function, it'll just average out, not contributing anything to the average energy. So that's why the leading order contribution appears as Laplacian. So one little footnote here is if you move your distribution function closer to the uniaxial equilibrium state, this energy would reduce to the Frank elasticity energy, and the distribution function reduces to just a vector with a fixed equilibrium order parameter. So in this particular case, yes. I'm considering. Yes, I will not talk about that. But over here, I have this spherical interaction region that, you know, neglecting the actual shape of the molecule, that would give me a one constant approximation here. The theory has two parts, just like the original DOI theory. The first part is an evolution equation for this second moment tensor, which I call A. This kappa is the velocity gradient tensor. So up to this point, that's what DOI had up there. And this is the new contribution due to the spatial variation of the molecular distribution. And this dr here is the rotational diffusivity averaged over all directions. And this u is a constant. And this indicating how strongly molecules interact. And this L here is the interaction length. That's something that you have to give. OK, that's the parameter, this L here. The second thing, which is more interesting, anyway, is you have to derive a non-local stress tensor. And we did this through the virtual work principle. You have this blob of material. You apply some kind of virtual strength to it. And the virtual deformation then gives you a virtual work from which you can back out the elastic stress tensor. And this virtual work is equated to the change in the free energy due to this imposed strain. Oh, yes, I forgot to say that. I will say that at the very end. Yes, you do need a closure, yes. And a couple of wrinkles here in calculating this changing this virtual work. When you impose this virtual deformation, you see, this is the free energy due to this distortional part, let's say. If you take the variation of that, that comes down to the variation of the local. It comes down to the variation of your test molecule, and it comes down to that plus the variation of the background as well. So it has two parts, you see? When you do this thing, it has two parts. Your test molecule has been changed by your deformation, and so is the mean field background. So you have to account for those two parts. And it so happens that this change in the mean is in this mean field background, this spatial derivative here does not commute with the variation. So that introduces the elastic stress, actually. That's the equivalent of the Frank elasticity, of the Erickson stress. And eventually, you end up with a stress tensor. And the second line here is the new contribution due to spatial distortion. And the top is just the elastic stress of DOI. A couple of features. I call it a non-local stress because traditionally, if you use Odoid B, you use all those kind of theories, the evolution equation of the orientational tensor is always a hyperbolic equation. It just travels down the streamline. Okay, it just remembers its own history. It doesn't care what's happening in the neighborhood. But this guy, this theory does care for the neighborhood, so it's non-local in that sense. And this asymmetric stress tensor, and you can work out the stress tensor, the asymmetry, actually that balances exactly the molecular torque. If you take a little blob of material, if there's asymmetry, then this thing would rotate, right? That rotation is prevented by the molecular torque, because this molecule would experience the torque if it's tweaked because of the mean field background. So that works out perfectly. And finally, you need a closure approximation to treat that fourth moment tensor in order to do a flow calculation. And Georgia is going to tell you about this flow calculation now. The derivation is, I can give you the details later on. Oh, wait a sec.
As Jimmy said, I'm going to show you results of applying the complete theory to shear flows. But first, I want to back out a little and digress, giving you the motivation why we chose shear flows, first of all, and then some related issues that maybe most of you know, but I think that have to be clear in mind to understand what I'm going to show you. Why do we analyze shear flows in particular instead of other type of flows? Well, it's known that for liquid crystalline materials, if one does pure extensional flows like fiber spinning or things like that, everything goes okay, and you have an enhancement of the natural alignment of the liquid crystalline material. The problem comes about instead in shear, especially for tumbling liquid crystal. As Professor Mather had mentioned on Wednesday, when you have tumbling liquid crystal, you end up with both generation of disclination in shear. That's not the case for floor lining liquid crystal.
Okay, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Can you tell before playing with it whether a liquid crystal will be floor lining or tumbling?
No, you have to make it a shear and see what happens. And why instead, to get back to your question, what happens in shear flow, what exactly tumbling is, if you think about a suspension of rods, you just have the rotation of the single rods in the viscous flow, and you have a Brownian motion of the single rods that desynchronizes the rotation. So if you consider not the single rod, but the average distribution of rods, then you end up with an overall distribution which is floor aligning. The problem instead in liquid crystalline materials is that you have the excluded volume interaction that drive the nematic phase that correlate the rotation of the single rod. So it might be that when you have a nematic liquid crystal, the average orientation itself keeps on tumbling. And that's what that usually causes problems and drive instabilities in the orientation and generation of defects. This is just a phase diagram for a monomain liquid crystal. If you have a very high correlation of the excluded volume effects, you have to go to very high shear rate to get orientation, to get flow aligning. Otherwise, your material keeps on tumbling. This is, again, a picture that part of it Jimmy has shown you of the PBG solution for Larson and Mead experiments. And what actually happens, depending on the shear rate at which they shear the material, starting from a nicely aligned sample, just a small region of misalignment, the sample undergoes a first transition at early strains with the appearance of birefringent bands perpendicular to the flow direction. And only at later times do they see the stripes that Jimmy analyzed. And the fact that this is not only true for lyotropic liquid crystalline system, but different texture can appear also for thermotropic, depending also on the initial condition. With this is a Vectra, and for chain not an initially well-aligned sample, you get more complicated textures appearing as shear. To sum up the equations that Jimmy has just presented you of our version of complete molecular model, we have to solve the flow part, continuity and momentum transport with a stress that comes from the presence of my liquid crystalline material. And then we have an evolution equation for the orientation. Actually, we won't solve for the full distribution function of the orientation, but this is the tensor A that in Jimmy's transparency, and I call it S. And then we need some sort of closure because there are fourth moment of the distribution function.
If you're writing down the gradient terms, you were guided only by symmetry. You just wrote down all the gradient terms of that order, the symmetry allowed. How many, how bad would it be? How many coefficients would you have floating around?
Any one or?
No, no, less than that.
Yes. Oh, after you use the symmetry.
Yeah, it's.
You begin, okay, you start with 81, it comes down maybe to 9, something like that.
Maybe less than that.
6?
6 when it's, when you diagonalize it, it's 6 components. And when it's non diagonalized, with respect to the directory, it's 9.
Moderately hard.
Yeah. But you, by doing that, it's, I mean, from here, you have some physical meaning of the length scale that you introduce. In that way, you have, those are just parameters. Okay, so we use those equation to model shear flows. First thing we did was looking at a two-dimensional geometry where we look at the plane flow shear gradient direction with just a two-dimensional geometry, two-dimensional velocity field, but a fully three-dimensional orientation field. And what we saw, first of all, the thing we did was, okay, let's try to understand what tumbling does to the orientational instability. So we looked just at the case where the orientation was in the plane of shear and trying to understand what it does. And we see that as a result of the tumbling, we have a modulation across my gap. So now I'm, this would be the shear gradient direction. This would be the upper wall. This is the out plane. We see the appearance of a modulation both in the orientation angle and in the order parameter. So the appearance of a texture which with a characteristic length scale that decreases in time and at a certain point saturates. And as when I see the saturation of the length scale of the modulation of my orientation, also I see that tumbling is suppressed. So this is a proof that the process of tumbling is what causes the modulation in my orientation, the appearance of defects.
What do you, when you say tumbling is suppressed, how do you, you have an irregular pattern, so how do you define
it? I see that my the angle formed by the director and the flow doesn't keep on being a constant rotation.
But this is averaged over the whole sample with all of its irregularities?
No, at each point.
So you reach a steady state.
It's not a steady state because the system keeps on wagging and the modulation is wags across the gap. So it's not a steady state. It's just that the average spacing between the modulation becomes a constant.
But the wagging part might well be a limitation of the closure in the model, actually.
That's also the case. And what we also looked at whether the characteristic length scale that appears as a result of this process agrees with what we thought was the correct scaling that need to be expected from the three players that we have in the system that drive the evolution. Molecular elasticity, distortional elasticity, and viscous forces. Those are the three key elements. And as a result, we expect that the characteristic length scale of the texture should scale with a characteristic length scale of the distortional elasticity and the ratio U over Deborah number to the one off.
Is that merge scaling with U, with an extra with U inserted somehow? I mean, that is, what's the dominant balance that you're doing to get that? Is it distortional against viscous or?
No, you have to keep one thing, we basically moved along a line where the ratio of these two was constant. The ratio of these two was constant, and then we compared, we changed this.
So you constant Deborah number varying the Erickson number?
Constant interplay of these two and varying the Erickson number.
So is this something like a Marucci scaling, but you've applied the molecular interpretation of the elastic constant?
Yeah.
So
because Marucci scaling was done in the context of the Leslie-Erickson theory, so it just had distortional elasticity and viscous torque to balance.
So what I see here is that as Deborah number gets very small, then the length scale of the texture gets very large compared to molecular dimensions, which is, of course, what you want.
Yeah.
Sort of the scaling
regime. And then the dependence with the characteristic length scale of distortional elasticity. So these are the...
Oh, so L, that little L is not the molecular dimension?
No, little L is the length scale of distortional elasticity.
Okay. Then how is that made non-dimensional? What's relative to what? How's that made dimensional?
Little L?
Yeah.
Well, it's capital L in your equation.
Yeah,
so
my cap.
That's relative to a rod length, or what's the, how's that made dimensional?
Yeah, that when you, the length scale of distortional elasticity is related to the molecular dimension. Because it comes from excluded volume effect always, so.
For the polymeric crystals, I should think of little L as something more like a persistence length of the LCP.
Yeah, I would say that.
I think it's more, this is the one adjustable primary.
But it's related to that because it comes from excluded volume effect, so it has to be related to that.
It's supposed to be a lot larger than the
persistence length. Yeah, it's sort of a persistence link for the in space, and if you want to.
Yeah.
Not molecular persistence.
But in any case, you need another molecular theory to predict it.
Yeah.
So suppose I picked a particular.
Well, you can derive if you try to derive the Marucci-Greco potential from a non-Saguier form.
Okay, so
then you can, you should be able to relate this L to the geometric parameters of my rod.
Okay, a separate question is, let me try to put this. You have a parameter U that appears in the molecular theory that doesn't appear in any of the phenomenological theories. So if I can, if I tried to convert this scaling to something involving viscosities, that involve hydrodynamic parameters, does it reduce to the Marucci scaling? Is it Marucci scaling re-expressed in terms of the underlying parameters of the molecular model?
I don't think that you can, and in the Marucci scaling or in the Leslie-Erickson-Frank theory, there's nothing that can relate it to U, because U is a measure of molecular viscoelasticity.
Well, certainly the
and so
Frank elastic constants will depend on both U and L.
Yes.
And so I guess the question is if you try to, is it possible to re-express this?
Yeah. We got to the weak flow limit of our complete theory, and we got an expression that relates the Frank elastic constant and the viscosity to U and L. We did that.
We reduced this general theory back to Leslie-Erickson.
In the limiting case where the slow flows and weak distortions.
Okay, so in that limit, is this Marucci scaling? That's the question.
But James' question is whether this scaling reduces to
the Marucci
scaling.
Yeah,
in that limit.
Yeah.
That's
the theory that we use to the frequency.
I see the texture length scale that goes is shear rate to the minus 1/2 power. So I say this is Marucci scaling.
So in the limit where you've only got a certain number of parameters, dimensional analysis tells you there's probably only one way to write that scaling.
And it seems that things work quite nicely. This is the characteristic length scale versus the this is the other L, I change characters, should be the small L instead of lambda, and this is U over Deborah number to the one off.
So you've done what Wes asked, at least in two dimensions. You've gotten to the point you've entered the scaling machine where the system's no longer really terribly sensitive to the, because if you've got a texture that just depends on the shear rate and is no longer sensitive to the size of your box that scales the right way, then you're essentially doing what he asked.
Yeah, I think so.
But this was for a two-dimensional geometry where we can find it thanks to the plane of shear. And that's a key thing, because what actually happens in real materials is that you, as soon as you start shearing, then you have the appearance of this banded texture. And that's what we try to capture by our simulation. We took the previous geometry, but we did not fix the orientation in the plane of shear. We allowed a fully three-dimensional orientation, and we see what happened. And what happened is that at a certain point, the director becomes unstable, and we did not observe the same type of evolution as before with a tumbling generating defects, and that, and at a certain point, reaching a steady state texture. But what happens before that is that the director, the average orientation, tips out of the shear planes, become unstable. And this tipping out of the director from the shear plane to the outer plane is depends on what along what position along the flow I am. There is a modulation of the director angle along the flow, and as a result of this, the intensity profile also is modulated. And so it would be something like moving along a line in Larson Mead's picture.
Is this, hold on, so these are the bands that are with the axis of the bands along the vorticity direction.
Yes.
Vorticity direction.
Yes.
So you don't have fully three-dimensional simulation to do this?
No.
No,
it's not.
We do not have the any dependence along the vorticity direction. So
2D simulation in a different direction.
Yeah, it's really moving like a line along the flow. So we don't know if...
So the director is, or the structures can live in three dimensions, but your simulation...
But I'm looking at a plane, yeah.
And
but what it's important is that we see that the director tips out, and that's what it's driven here. So we hope that if this is the right direction.
Is the structure fully coupled to the velocity field? That is, once the structure starts tipping out of the plane, you have out-of-plane velocity components too. Is that here?
No, we have a fully, only two-dimensional velocity field here.
Okay, so you haven't yet dealt with the momentum equation, really?
No. In it's fully coupled in the plane of shear, but we do not allow any three any.
But you're right. Yeah, we're fully 3D calculation.
So, once they don't allow any modulation in the vorticity direction, it's consistent not to allow any flow along that direction either. That's
no. No, because you have out of plane motion of the director, momentum conservation dictates you have to have some additional flow on out of plane.
You can have conservation of mass but having left and right.
Yeah. So, see this other guy sitting over here, he's going to do 3D. So.
Good for you, man. How are the simulations different from our results with HAM back in the 90s, published in Macromology in 94?
Yeah.
Do you see anything different?
You did Leslie Erickson calculation, yes. I think the characteristic length scale, you also got more or less the right thing, that we went to much higher. You could not observe, for instance, things like the modulation in the order parameter, because you had the Leslie Erickson.
Yeah, right, it's like one. 0.1 per second, so it's very low.
And instead, we went to a different regime of shear rates.
Could I characterize the regime you're in as one where the Deborah number is important?
Yes.
In order to be resolving any texture, then the physical dimension of your computation cell has to be very small.
Yes, yes, yes. And what is important is, just qualitatively, is that if we start with surface anchoring, either in the plane of shear, so either in the flow direction or in the shear gradient, our simulation and experiments do see the prediction of the appearance of these bands. If I start my simulation or in the experiments, if I already orient the orientation along the vorticity direction, in my simulation everything is stable. There is no appearance of bands.
Even if you perturb it deliberately?
Yes. The perturbation dies off, and the stable uniform orientation along the vorticity is fine.
Are you now doing periodic, or is you also have a cell? You have anchoring conditions with the cell walls?
No, only at the side walls. It's periodic along the flow direction. There's no anchoring along the flow direction.
The top and bottom plate, which are
anchored. Yeah.
But the appearance of the bands is really a response of the director getting wound up, and then it tips towards the vorticity. So if it already starts the vorticity, then it's not going to.
Then it's fine.
That stage.
Yeah. This is what they've seen, experience, and also our simulation do see the same kind of things. The problem is our simulation cannot predict the strides, the second textural instability that they see in real life. And so to predict actually that, and also the difference in time scale, that the tipping into the vorticity is much quicker when I start with a vorticity with the director along the flow versus the director along the shear gradient. There's an order of magnitude difference in this time scale. It's consistent with what it's observed in experiment. But we wanted to try to predict not only the banded texture, we wanted to try to predict the stripe texture. Basically what Jimmy has done using the Leslie-Erickson model, but using a molecular model in order to A, access the Deborah-Number cascade, going to high shear rate where Leslie-Erickson is not applicable, and also all the troubles that Jimmy still had in the sense that there were disagreement between the prediction and experiments, for instance, in the position of the defects. Jimmy saw that defects, mainly the highest tipping of the director was in the center of the rolls, instead the experiments show that they form between the rolls. And basically, we believe that only with the complete molecular model we can mimic what is seen in experiments. And basically this is a diagram to show, this is the regions that were accessed by Larson and Mead experiments of the in the Erickson Deborah number parameter space. This is for very low Deborah number, for very low shear rate, a region which is called the Erickson number cascade, where Leslie-Erickson might be applicable. And this is the Deborah number cascade that we want to try to study. And this is the reference that we are going to do. And the type of geometry is the same as the one that Jimmy has just described. We looked at only at the cross section. The main flow is out of the board, and we do not allow any variation along the flow direction. So it's still not a fully 3D calculation. We have a 3D orientation and velocity field, but variational only along two directions. And details of the numerics, but I do not have time. And like in Jimmy's calculation, I also see the appearance of secondary flow roll cells. This is my cross section, and I do see the appearance of these rolls, which also have an aspect ratio roughly of 1. And the rolls, these roll cells, I, instead of having the picture of the velocity field, I indicate them with a secondary vorticity, so the pictures are more clear, I hope. The appearance of this roll structure in the velocity fields gives rise to a corresponding structure in the orientation. And in more details, in between the roll cells, the order parameter becomes really low from the equilibrium value. It drops down in the region in between the rolls to value close to zero, to an isotropic phase. So this seems to be exactly the appearance of defects cores between the roll cells.
So here again, in order to get these phenomena occurring in sort of the same simulation, you've had to have squeezed the real macroscopic dimension way down, I assume.
Yeah.
Relative to the actual conditions of the large CMU experiment.
Say it again.
Well, in Jimmy's simulations, using that as the Erickson, the assumption would be that you basically have the equilibrium order parameter everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is an Erickson number, say, in the same range. Jimmy was looking at a few hundred, but you have a Deprey number.
No, I have a much higher Erickson number. Erickson number is 10 to the 4.
Yeah, OK.
Well, that's comparable to the highest ones he looked at.
But a much higher Deborah number.
Yeah. So the only way you can get those things close together or within a few orders of magnitude is if thinking in terms of real experiments is if the dimensions are very small.
Why is that?
Yeah, you need to.
So in Larson,
talk about this,
in Larson's experiment, if the Erickson number was 10,000, his Deborah number would have been 10 to the minus 4 or something like that.
This was more or less Larson experience was this kind of things. When he went to the high Deborah number regime, the Erickson number were 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7. And basically, we are looking something around here, slightly lower Erickson number, because at that point, this characteristic length scale of the texture would be slightly larger, and we'd be able to capture with our mesh size.
Yeah.
So, but we are not, we are just a couple of orders of magnitude lower in Erickson number.
Yeah,
this makes sense. I think what you said was right, because if you had done the experiment with this, with those parameters, physical parameters, then your size sets are very small, so the Erickson number is not too big, but the Deborah number is high.
Right, the related question is, if you had run it with this, if you had had a low Deborah number
mm-hmm.
at the same conditions with these, one or two orders of magnitude lower Deborah number, would these regions where the order parameter goes almost to zeros persist? You might.
We have to run this code for low values of Deborah number and try to see what we can say about the Erickson number cascade. There are some numerical issues that our code, it's not performing well. It has some convergence trouble when you go to low Deborah number. So we have still to, I mean, I got the code to run it in February, so these are still preliminary results.
In the regions where the order parameter dips down low, is there also
corresponding to the modulation in the order parameter, there's also a structure in this is, I show here the angle form between, I start with the director along the vorticity axis, and in between the rolls where the defect, where the order parameter drops down, the director tips toward the flow direction.
Flow direction is to the right.
It's out of the plane.
Yeah.
This I'm looking at the cross sections.
So these low order parameter regions look more like, that sounds like they look more like strength one than strength one half explanations in that sense.
Also says the character is different.
Yeah, because
the gravitational field around those low order parameter regions, do they actually resemble that order one defect?
No, I haven't plotted the defect, the order, the orientation field, so I do not know if it's a more a plus one or a plus one off. Yeah. Above the it's. The only thing is a three-dimensional plot. I haven't yet figured out a good way to plot it.
You can show the two-dimensional cross-section superimposed on a color map.
Yeah.
Not a plane.
That could be a way. And as a result of this, basically I'm looking now at, in a Larson picture along a line in my cross-section, and if from my orientation field I compute the transmitted light intensity, I also see the appearance of some stripes, as in Jimmy's calculation. And what's important is that the characteristic length scale of the texture along the vorticity refines in time. as seen in experiments. And
be careful in comparing those with experiments, because there's also this lensing effect. Mohan Srinivasarayan talks about that in his papers.
I haven't that reference.
You're probably just using the science career term, but there's also focusing and defocusing of mind that gives rise to this. So the comparison of experiments
is correct. Oh, okay.
We want a solution of Maxwell's equations inside.
Yeah, and also I think that they try to quantify.
Is the optical state focusing software that can build the director distribution? If you reduce this to a director, then you can get the transmission intensity. So that problem's already been solved much more.
And I don't know how much time. Anyway, at different Deborah numbers, there seemed to be a transition across the tumbling wagon transition from a texture that refines and fills up the materials with a completely isotropic domain, and other instead, when I increase the further up the shear rate, I seem to reach a steady state of a characteristic length scale, but things are still to be tested.
So the work exposure you're using without just in the basic DOI model is one that won't yield flow alignment?
No. That's why I can't go. I mean, if I'm pushing away up the shear rate, I have a wagging that has such a long period that it's basically flow aligning, but the closure does not allow flow aligning. So. But these calculation at high Deborah number, I done Deborah number of 100, sorry. So hopefully it's very close to a flow aligning regime. And we still have to analyze how different type of boundary condition would affect the evolution of the system and the characteristic scaling, the characteristic time for the evolution of the texture. Or trying to look not only at the texture itself, but at what is the rheological response, things like first normal stress difference at the wall or shear stress. But for sure, for quantitative comparison with experience, we need, first of all, to go to fully three-dimensional calculation. And we need some good data, because the only thing that we have to are those Larson and Mead work or Jan Leibs, but just images and no quantitative data on time scales and detail local orientation of my field.
So have you tweaked this L parameter?
In this calculation, for now we have done those runs where at roughly a small range of Ericsson numbers, so we haven't changed L that much. It might be interesting. Again, the issue of going way up in the Ericsson number would be you need at that point very fine mesh to resolve the details.
So before going to 9 parameters or 6, whichever it is, which the maximum symmetry allows, I guess an intermediate point might be to pick some subset that allows you to at least have independent values for the Frank elastic constants.
Well, actually, the Marucci and Greco developed their potential. The picture that Jimmy had shown you was only for integrating the interaction of a rod with a circular environment, but they did their calculation with a not spherical environment. And so they had a 2-parameter mean field potential that resulted in a corresponded more or less to the 3 Frank elastic constant being different. 2 parameters, but 3 Frank elastic constants different. So that's already being done.
So there's nothing fundamentally that prevents you from using that potential in a model like this?
No, it's just that we tried the derivation of the stress tensor at that point would be very complicated, because when you have that additional term, we use that additional term in the Marucci-Greco potential the math gets really, really messy, and you get six terms and derivatives of the fourth moment, and we don't know how to treat that.
Actually, there's more to it than that. It's not easy to generalize the theory to the elastic anisotropic case. We run into all kinds of troubles. It's tricky. Looks like the Murgi-Grigel potential is inadequate. That's my feeling now. I haven't really gotten to the bottom of it. Although you could have three elastic constants, which you can have two parameters, so they're related. But given that, the truncation seems to rule out a consistent way of dealing with what's really happening. I mean, if you use this truncated form, you have trouble in deriving those elastic terms. It's not easily done. Some physicists have pointed out that if you do that, you would have a negative entropy production. But even beyond that, you still have other things. For instance, the torque balance will be violated somehow. Those point to some problem with the procedure of truncation. That's my feeling at this point.
I've seen that Niemola, professor that was here in the workshop, he tried to derive the Marucci-Grecker potential from an Onsager excluded volume type of calculation. And he's still working on that, and so might be a way to get a Niemola.
So that has not been done, and I'm very surprised. And
Onsager way to derive the mean field potential for non-homogeneous case, no. And so he has started working on that by the chat we had. And
I have an exact theory. I just have not put in I have an exact theory for calculating all the elastic constant. I still need to implement it, but it's formula is all there. I can easily put in the Onsager thing.
You should be quick because
I thought this could not be done. Is this a better theory?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
One quick question about the need for 3D simulation. Is it experimentally, are the defects lined up along the flow primarily?
Mostly.
At the point where you're seeing them early in the development of these textures, things are pretty lined up on the flow. As it gets more and more turbulent, if you will, then you can't really see the stuff so well. Matt?
In terms of like what Jimmy was predicting, when they first nucleate, they're really straight right along the streamline, so I think that's fine.
But for instance, things like the banded texture, you can't predict.
Well, aside from observations, I mean, I guess intuitively you do expect these loops to get ever more stretched out along the flow direction.
The bands is a big problem, although maybe you can do it to make your simulation plane the other axis, because those are so symmetric about the other plane. So just have simulation be the velocity.
Really easy to simulate the stripes if you slice it this way, and it's really easy to simulate bands, because that's all you can simulate.
That's basically what we have done.
So they did two-thirds of what you asked for. You get two or three dimensions.
I think it's, you know, created that in some global sense. It's just too easy to be tricked to say, well, I simulated something that makes a band, and hence I must have solved the problem that is present in the experiment. I'm pretty much not convinced and won't be convinced until these things self-consistently come out where you haven't preordained what the texture is you're going to predict by the choice of which plane you simulate.
In terms of bands, you know, if you work in this area, these materials form bands all the time. If you get a piece of liquid crystal, you blow on it, and it will form a band. Right, so if you breathe next to it, so if you heat it up from below a little bit, whatever you do, you always see bands. So bands is a generic thing, and for all kinds of systems. So I think there are many origins to all these bands, as people have observed, and these are, you know, under magnetic fields, flow fields, thermal gradient, you name it. So,
okay. This model, how you're describing the molecular level effects, like if you have effects on the molecular level, it somehow misses this, because you're describing mesoscopic. Your points, your mesh is presumably mesoscopic, it's not microscopic. So if you have some pinhole or something else happening with them on a molecular scale, with hooks or...
You will not be able to do it because the theory is based on the Marucci-Grieco energy, assumes the spatial variation of your distribution function is mild. So you have an appreciable variation only over many, many
molecular dimensions.
So if you cannot account for that.
It's just already when you use a continuum description, you're already coarse-graining, so you can't resolve the microscopic detail. It's a mesoscopic description, mesoscopic theory.
It's an important question, though, because if you wanted to try and put in elements of this kind of thing, I guess you could think of them as like a deep level defects.
Aren't the cores actually big compared to molecular scale? I mean, I know the interfacial thickness for an IM transition is quite wide. Which is somehow related. It's the same for contrast or balance of free energies to get you the core thickness.
The core could be ten times the large transition of micron across.
No,
maybe
the thick ones, but
you mean the
nanometer
scale?
Sure. Yeah,
it's
a few molecules or
that's why the when you have singular cores, nobody really knows. You know, there are many theoretical treatments of the cores, the state of the core, but actual experiments match of the core. There are some observations of some chirality on some cores, -1/2 for LCPs.
So by the Marucci-Grieco picture postulates that is only valid because it's computation of the series is only valid, assuming that cores are fat compared to molecules, but that's not necessarily true experimentally.
The cores are fat and smooth and anisotropic melted core.
So even this molecular picture that can resolve sort of molecular details of what a core is probably not,
right?
Is already by its construction to not strictly valid.
Is it early?
Well, basically allows a transition to an isotropic state.
Well,
but not all,
I
not
like
it's not
say,
necessarily defect cores
I
are
like
melted.
I like to say, exactly defect cores, at least all the calculations from different models. Right, and also from symmetry, the defect core is not isotropic. So it is a specific state, is what we call a planar biaxial.
Where the orientation is away from the.
So you have planar biaxial state, and you have. You have
pancakes. If you take this thing, if you take this line defect at the center here, you would have a pancake.
Yeah.
Your molecular distribution in the center is all the ones in the plane, but not the ones out of the plane.
You computed. Did you use Monte Carlo simulation?
Yeah. So, is there any hope of gradient theory being useful even right at the IN transition? I get. So the deeper you go into the thematic phase, the worse it gets. Presumably, the core has to tighten up.
Well, the Lando and Degen, you can calculate the same thing.
Your result is how different were from Lando and Degen.
For small rods, it was the same. For big rod, for long aspect ratio, there was a different structure that we found where in the center, the rods were along the core, but then there was some biaxial region that surrounded that before you got to the far field. But
it's not clear. You essentially end up with Jean, use different parameters.